Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us on a Wednesday afternoon for a very interesting discussion today with author James Scott. We're going to be talking about his latest publication, Rampage. It's going to be an exciting way to have a lunch on a weekday. Before we get started, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the Seeger Center for Asian Studies, as we are partnering with the Asia Policy Institute to host this event today. Seeger Center for Asian Studies is a university research institute at George Washington University. We host visiting scholars as well as affiliated faculty members at GW who focus on a wide array of topics related to Asia, Asia Pacific, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and East Asia. We also host a healthy amount of public seminars like the one today, where we invite different speakers from all over the world to talk about topics related to Asia, both in a historical context as well as in contemporary issues. Feel free to follow us in our events on our Seeger Center website. I'm sure some of you have received our mountains of emails, but thank you again for joining us today, and I'd like to pass on over to Mindy with Asia Policy Institute to introduce the event today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. My name is Mindy Cutler. I'm director of Asia Policy Point. We're a nonprofit research center here in Washington, D.C., that studies Japan and Northeast Asia, contemporary Japan and Northeast Asia, but we do it through the lens of history and how history affects security in the region. So we're a little bit more unique. We don't receive funding from Japan or major funding from any other organizations. So our most recent publication is a directory of the Japanese cabinet by name and organization. We're a membership nonprofit. That's our major form of support. We put out a weekly calendar of all events on that affect Asia policy in Washington and elsewhere, and a review of news from Japan. So I hope you will become members. And one of the things that we like to examine is Japanese war crimes and how they have affected the present. And I do an extensive amount of work on comfort women, in which we have some books for sale on comfort women, and also the American POW experience. I actually represent the American Defenders of Bataan and Corregidor here in Washington, so if you're interested in getting on my POW mailing list, I can be happy to put you on that. But we're here today to talk about, I'll put our history study group, about a piece of Pacific War history that has not ever gotten enough attention. Everyone knows about the destruction of Warsaw. Very few people remembered about the rape of Manila. And I thought that when I saw that James Scott, who is a well-known, well-regarded, award-winning author on several books on the Pacific War, the Doolittle Raiders,
The War Below and
Submarine Warfare, and this unique piece of history, which includes the war crime trials, and very timely in terms of what the Japanese did in terms of comfort women, the rape of women. I said, this is something we have to host. So we have the book, which is not out and will not be out until the end of October, but we have it for about half the price for a $20 donation, and plus you can get it signed, and I hope everyone will buy a book. So with that, before I speak, I'd like everyone to go around the table and introduce themselves so our author knows who he's talking to, and then we'll get into the presentation. And I want this to be a free and open discussion, and then we have commentary by the very famous historian Richard Frank, who wrote the book Downfall at the end of the Japanese Imperial Japan, and it's considered one of the definitive histories. So why don't we start with you.
Hi, my name is Grace Tong, and I'm an international lawyer and former State Department official. I work a lot on North Korean human rights.
Great.
My name is Riho Aizawa from Japan. Mm-hmm. I'm a student in Elliott School, master's degree course.
My name is Undo Choi. Currently, I'm staying here as a visiting scholar. member. I'm working for the Northeast Asian History Foundation in Seoul, Korea.
Okay, great.
And this semester, my research focus is about U.S. occupation over Japan, so I'm interested in General MacArthur's
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, my name is Sue. I'm an exchange student from Korea. And I didn't know that it's a kind of formal meeting, so I was just passing by and I thought it was interesting, so I came.
Welcome.
What's your last name?
Cho.
Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you.
As we say, you chose wisely.
I'm Sharon Chamberlain. I'm an adjunct here at GW off and on, and my main research focus is the war crime trials conducted in Manila after the war.
My name is James Sang. I'm retired, but my mother and two brothers arrived in Manila in December of 1941 under President Harrison and left in May of 1945.
So they were there for the worst of it, yeah.
Were they interned?
No, they were diplomats and they managed to hide out in the Chinese community.
Got it.
For 4 years. No, it was very. It would be 60 stories.
My name is Julia. I'm from the Philippines. I was born in Manila in the fateful year of 1942. I spent my career here with the old band where I retired after 30 years working as death specialist around the world. And I'm doing volunteer services in the church, in the community. And I'm calling myself.
Great. And welcome.
My name is Dodi Sedrigan. I'm here with my wife. We're both from Makaini. Mm-hmm. We are both twice retiree. And I was born in Manila. Mm-hmm. And I remember very well when I was in 19th year when the intense Manila, Battle of Manila was going on. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, my father had the opportunity to go to Rizal province and hide there and mm-hmm. sit out the war. Mm-hmm. But the atrocities, when we came back to Manila, the traces of the atrocities was very, I don't know how to describe it, sears in your brain and mind. And I could not explain to myself why such violence and rampage went on. Mm-hmm. Anyway, after my retirement, it was time for me to pay back to the community. So my expertise was in journalism, so I wrote some columns for our community newspaper called the Manila Mail.
Terrific. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Lex Galak. I'm a policy advisor for the U.S. Asia Institute, which deals with ASEAN issues, mm-hmm. current and past.
Thank you. Welcome.
I'm Al O'Neill, a retired Foreign Service officer. I spent a little bit more than 20 years in Asia, mm-hmm. Including 3 years as political counselor in Manila,
okay.
From 97 to 2000. And I was also earlier in Tokyo for a few years, and then I was Consul General in Okinawa mm-hmm. right before Manila assignment. So I'm very interested. I lived above, I worked above the room in which the
courtroom.
Amasha trial
yeah, exactly.
took place.
Wow.
And it's the embassy ballroom.
And his jail cell was up there. It had been the High Commissioner's son's bedroom, I think, that they converted into his jail cell. Yeah.
I could look out from my office without getting up from my desk and see the Bataan Peninsula, mm-hmm. and if I motivated myself to go out to my veranda, I could see Corregidor.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Fascinating.
Interesting place.
Yeah, it really
full
is.
Of ghosts.
Yeah, very much so.
My name is Robert Weiner. I'm a Center Associate at the Data Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. Minor point, my father fought in the Philippines 37 years.
Wow.
My name is Camilla Durham, an undergraduate student at the Philippines.
Jack Reed, I'm in the public, and I saw on the website that it interests just in history in this area.
My name is Zhongping Han. I'm a third year PhD student in history department at GW.
So my research focusing on wars in East Asia, mainly World War II and Civil War.
Great. Good morning. My name is Wayne Brown, graduate student in the Elliott School, Masters of International Policy and Practice.
Hi, I'm Diana Bendel. I'm an undergraduate student here and a research assistant at the Sacred Center.
Great.
Hi, my name is Jeff Wooden. I'm an intern with Ms. Mindy Cutler at Asia Policy Point.
Interesting.
John Malagrito, I'm a son of a Filipino World War II veteran. I'm with the Filipino Veterans Recognition and Education Project, and also the editor of Manila Mail.
Great, welcome.
My name is Ayumi Akiyama. I'm a research assistant at Asia Policy Project with Ms. Mindy Cutler.
Great. Oh, and Richard. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Well,
okay. Let's.
Yeah. Welcome, and thank you all for coming out on a busy afternoon. I'm sure everybody has a lot going on, and thanks to Richard for helping to get everything set up and squared away, and Mindy, of course, who reached out to me a while ago to invite me to come. It's a real a privilege and honor to be here, and also want to thank Richard Frank for coming out. Who's I didn't realize he was going to be here today, and I'm a huge fan of his work, his wonderful book Guadalcanal, and of course Downfall on the end of the war in World War II. So it's a real honor to get to sit here with Richard today. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Rampage. The book doesn't actually come out until the end of next month, but I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a sneak peek about that story. I've got a presentation that runs approximately about a half an hour, and then we'll have a great discussion, questions, anything like that. So thank you. And I'll slide out of the way so I'm kind of not in the not right here blocking the screen. I think it might be a little bit easier. American General Douglas MacArthur was driven from the Philippines at the start of World War II, and he famously vowed to return. And this is the untold story of his homecoming. The 29-day battle to retake Manila in February 1945 proved a fight unlike any other in the Pacific War. A bloody urban brawl that forced American soldiers to battle block by block, home by home, and even room by room. The end result was the catastrophic destruction of the city and a rampage by Japanese troops that terrorized the civilian population. Landmarks were demolished, neighborhoods torched, countless women raped, their husbands and children murdered. An estimated 100,000 civilians died during the Battle of Manila, many of them in massacres as heinous as the rape of Nanking. Not only did the battle give American war planners a glimpse of what retaking the Japanese homeland might involve, but those brief weeks in February 1945 forever transformed the city once known as the Pearl of the Orient, and decimated generations of Filipino families, the ripples of which still echo through lives even today, almost 75 years later. Now, to appreciate, truly appreciate the tragedy of the Battle of Manila, it's important to rewind to the turn of the 20th century. The United States had captured the Philippines, along with Cuba, during the Spanish-American War. But unlike Cuba, for which we granted independence, America decided to hold on to the Philippines. The rationale was best described by Arthur MacArthur, who was General Douglas MacArthur's father, and who'd helped capture Manila during the Spanish-American War and later served as military governor. Quote, "The archipelago," he told Congress in 1902, "is the finest group of islands in the world. Its strategic position is unexcelled by that of any other position on the globe." Now, policymakers realized that Manila, which would serve as the nation's front door to the markets in China, India, and Malaysia, needed a facelift to help attract industry and reflect America's growing global status. So to spearhead that transformation, the U.S. recruited famed architect and city planner Daniel Burnham, who over the course of his career guided cities like San Francisco and Chicago. He took part in the redo of the National Mall in the early 1900s and also was the architect for Union Station here in D.C. Burnham saw great potential in Manila with its vast natural resources, its old Spanish churches, and the old walled city of Intramuros, which is the 160-acre historic heart of Manila, which was built soon after the city's founding in 1571. Quote, slide this out a little bit. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. There we go. Possessing the Bay of Naples, the winding river of Paris, and the canals of Venice, Burnham wrote in his plan, Manila has before it an opportunity unique in the history of modern times, the opportunity to create a unified city equal to the greatest in the Western world with the unparalleled and priceless addition of a tropical setting. In the four decades leading up to World War II, Manila developed into a small slice of America, home not only to thousands of U.S. service members, but employees with companies like B.F. Goodrich, Del Monte, and General Electric. Often called the Pearl of the Orient, the city boasted a great quality of life, with department stores and social clubs, golf courses, swimming pools, and bowling alleys. The New York Times described it best in 1932 when they said, quote, "Manila is by far the most beautiful city of all the Orient. From the top of the University Club, it seems half hidden in a canopy of trees, green everywhere, a city within a park." Now, on the eve of World War II, one of Manila's most famous residents was none other than General Douglas MacArthur, who lived with his wife and four-year-old son in the penthouse atop the luxurious Manila Hotel. Like his father, Douglas MacArthur's life was long intertwined with the Philippines, where he'd spent many tours throughout his military career. Quote, "In this city," he once said, "my mother had died, my wife had been courted, my son had been born." Now, for MacArthur, who was the son of a career military officer who'd spent his childhood pinballing around the United States and the world, Manila was really the closest thing he had to a hometown. And more, of course, than just MacArthur, loved the Philippines. Quote, "To live in Manila in 1941, remembered CBS News correspondent Bill Dunn, was to experience the good life." Battery must be dying. But the good life ended on December 7, 1941, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and invaded the Philippines. Hoping to avoid a bloody battle for the capital, MacArthur declared Manila an open city and evacuated his forces to the Bataan Peninsula and the fortified island of Corregidor. For MacArthur, this was far more than just a strategic retreat. He was abandoning his home, forced to leave so fast that the family did not have time even to take down their Christmas tree. Japanese troops fanned out through the capital, rounding up thousands of American civilians and interning them at the University of Santo Tomas, which is a 50-acre school in Manila. MacArthur endured 77 days in the tunnels of Corregidor before escaping in a torpedo boat with his family and staff. For MacArthur, it was an agonizing event, forced to leave behind thousands of American and Filipino soldiers who had trusted him. Troops who would soon face the infamous Death March, years in Japan's notorious prisoner of war camps, and perilous trips on board hell ships back up to Japan. When MacArthur reached Australia, he made a public vow, "I shall return," his famous promise. And that promise would drive him over the next 2 years, 9 months, and 29 days as he clawed his way north across the jungles of New Guinea. Now, Manila suffered greatly.
Well, there it goes.
Yeah. Something's important. It's not the forward arrow. Yeah. Oh, yeah, thank you. Manila suffered greatly during the 3 years of the enemy's occupation. Japanese forces looted food supplies and department stores, stole farm equipment, left fields to rot. Store shelves sat empty, and basic supplies like medicines vanished. Manila's economy totally collapsed, and the social fabric began to unravel. An army of beggars flooded the streets, while others resorted to thievery, including plundering of graves in search of dentures, eyeglasses, and even clothing. Anything that could be bartered or sold to buy a fistful of rice. Families unable to care for their children went so far as to abandon them to orphanages, or even sell them. Starvation, meanwhile, ran rampant, claiming as many as 500 souls a day in Manila. Marshall Achalco, a Manila attorney whose diary captured the horror many endured, described it best in December 1944. Quote, "Today we are living under conditions in which only the fittest among us can hope to survive." And I think this quote here, which I found on an intelligence report in 1944, really captures in just one sentence how awful that times had gotten in Manila, when it's cheaper to buy a child than it is, thank you, a pig. Now, American families locked up behind the gates of Santo Tomas and other Manila area internment camps suffered equally. The earlier ingenuity that these internees had shown toward transforming these campuses into small functioning cities faded as the daily caloric intake plummeted and starvation took hold. A medical survey conducted in January 1945 revealing, wow, we're still having problems. Thank you. That the average male internee had lost 51 pounds and the average female internee had lost 32. To survive, desperate internees ate dogs, cats, pigeons, and even rats, which as you can see from this diary entry right here, were selling for 8 pesos each on the camp's black market. Quote, I was worried about a lump in my stomach, Louise Goldthorpe wrote in another one of her diary entries. Then I found out it was my backbone. By January 1945, the nearly 3,700 internees at Santo Tomas starved to death at a rate of about 3 to 4 a day. These five gentlemen lost a combined total of 273 pounds during their incarceration. Well, we survived on hope, one internee said, hope that American forces would arrive. MacArthur's forces returned, of course, on January 9th, 1945. Hitting the beaches of Lingayen Gulf in the north of Luzon in preparation for the 100-mile drive south to liberate Manila. Standing in MacArthur's way, one slide ahead, however, was General Tomoyuki Yamashita, whose job was to turn the Philippines into a tar pit, to bog down American forces on their march north toward Japan. Now, Yamashita had proven himself early in the war when he had taken Singapore from the British, earning the nickname the Tiger of Malaya. But his rivalry with War Minister Hideki Tojo led Tojo to park him on the sidelines up in Manchuria for the rest of the war. Only following Tojo's ouster in the summer of 1944 was Yamashita's career resurrected. And just as MacArthur had come to the Philippines to redeem his promise, Yamashita was equally certain of his fate. He had come to die. But he did not plan to do so in Manila. Instead, he divided up his army and planned to fight a protracted battle in the woods and jungles of Luzon. Thanks, Richard. In contrast, Rear Admiral Sanji Iwabuchi, who commanded a much smaller Manila naval defense forces, had no intention of abandoning the capital, even if Yamashita had demanded it. Iwabuchi had been a failed sea captain earlier in the war. He'd had a ship shot out from under him in Guadalcanal and had survived, which was a disgrace in the Japanese culture at that time. He'd spent the rest of the war parked behind a desk, and only through the deaths of more capable officers had he seen his career resurrected, and he was sent to Manila. In Manila, he saw a chance to redeem himself by creating an urban bloodletting similar to Stalingrad. To accomplish this, he divided up his forces of about 17,000 soldiers and Marines into several geographic commands that covered north, central, and southern Manila. Iwabuchi's ultimate plan called for a defense centered around Intramuros, the ancient citadel guarded by towering walls. Around the walled fortress, he planned a perimeter of large concrete buildings, small fortresses, really, that were designed to withstand typhoons and even earthquakes. To make it harder for advancing Americans, the Japanese barricaded the insides of these buildings with desks, chairs, and bookcases. Going so far, actually, is to build these walls inside corridors, filling them with dirt, leaving just enough room over which they could throw a hand grenade. Thank you. Iwabuchi's forces likewise booby-trapped intersections. This is the corner of Dart and Oregon Streets, where Japanese set out 25 oil drums filled with concrete. They also sunk 16 railroad axles into the concrete and buried all sorts of landmines, including a beach mine, all of which was covered by a pillbox up in the top corner up there. This is actually a photograph of a Japanese tank trap, and you can see the ingenuity involved using old vehicles and poles, literally anchoring them with cables to a nearby tree. Now, to retake Manila, American forces carved up the capital. The 37th Infantry and the 1st Cavalry would come into the city from the north. The 37th Infantry would cross the river and swing toward the waterfront down by Intramuros, while the 1st Cavalry would envelop the city from the east and sort of have a similar thrust toward the waterfront. The 11th Airborne, meanwhile, would come up from the south and close the city's back door. Now, MacArthur was convinced that the Japanese would evacuate the city, just as he had done early in the war. The general was so confident of this fact that he had a staff begin to draw up plans for a liberation parade, down to picking the individual jeep assignments of where they would all ride. Complicating the challenge for American war planners was the conflicting intelligence. Filipino guerrilla reports in December talked about how Yamashita's forces were pulling out and things like that. But by January, those reports changed. Increasingly, they talked about landmines and building of pillboxes and the fortification of the city. Now, residents who for almost three long years had waited for MacArthur's return watched this fortification with alarm and terror. Quote, "Defeat is a bitter pill that the Japanese will not swallow," one resident wrote in her diary. "Defeat is the one thing that can turn them into beasts." 6:35 p.m. on February 3rd, the American cavalry rolled into Manila, prepared to liberate the city. In the northern suburbs, troops were greeted as celebrities. Nowhere was that more true than at Santo Tomas, the internment camp, where troops arrived around 8:30 p.m. that night. Internee Tressa Roca captured the excitement in her diary when she wrote, quote, "Before the men in the tanks knew what was going on, they were pulled out of them and lifted on the shoulders of our scrawny fellow internees. It was impossible to hold back the worshiping and joyous internees." Seems to be working, yeah. It's Richard, yeah. That night, starving internees feasted on army rations while American troops spoiled the children with candy. Frank Robertson, a reporter with International News Service, described just such a scene in his first dispatch from the camp. Quote, "One of the unforgettable things was the slow smile of wonderment on the pale, tense face of a little girl of four tasting chocolate for the first time." Of course, many in the city were starving as well. American troops throughout the battle would find themselves swarmed by hungry civilians. Here, a young Filipino girl clings to army rations that she'd been given. But the excitement over America's arrival proved short-lived. Iwabuchi gave the order on February 3rd to begin the planned destruction of the city. Incendiary squads swept through the districts north of the Pasig River and began setting fires and dynamiting buildings. MacArthur's pilot, Dusty Rhodes, witnessed the scene from the air. Quote, "The spectacle was an appalling sight. The entire downtown section of the city was a mass of flames," he wrote in his diary. "Flames were rising 200 feet in the air from the center of the city." And you can see all the smoke rising over Manila in the distance there. Manila residents grabbed what belongings they could carry and fled. In addition, the Japanese blew bridges over the river, which divided the city. Yeah, we'll just do it this way. Okay. After destroying the city's northern districts, the Japanese fell back across the river into central Manila, forcing American troops to cross the Pasig and begin what would prove to be an incredibly bloody urban fight. Block by block, American soldiers pressed deeper into the city, frequently slowed by the fortifications at intersections, which required troops to blast their way through adjacent buildings in order to attack the rear of a pillbox. Just as perilous were the fortified buildings, where Japanese Marines used the higher floors to target advancing Americans with Molotov cocktails and aerial bombs. Quote, "The preferred solution was to use cannons to blast the upper floors to rubble and then move in," one infantry officer wrote. Quote, "An equally favored alternative was to burn the building. When these alternatives wouldn't work, riflemen moved in to take the building floor by floor." One of the worst such battles occurred for Rizal Hall, the University of the Philippines, which you can see there right behind those troops. American and Japanese forces had spent 2 days battling for that one building. Finally, after 2 days, neither side was willing to quit, and daylight was fast vanishing. Both sides decided to spend the night inside the same blasted building. That evening, with the Americans hunkered down on the second floor on one side and the Japanese on the other, they listened. And on the opposite side of the building, the Americans could hear the Japanese began singing. Here's what they wrote in the report. Quote, "This commotion went on for about 45 minutes. culminating in a final burst of song and loud shouting, immediately followed by many reports of exploding grenades and dynamite charges. The cavalrymen continued to listen in the dark. More singing, more grenades, then silence. Detonations went off at half-hour intervals until around 4 a.m., at which